ascetic traditions then today are going to look at, and there's evidence for the development of ascetic traditions. We'll go back to the Rig Veda, as we'll see presently. And there's information in the Upanishads and from Buddhist sources. So we know about asceticism from the Upanishads, from Buddhist sources, and Jain sources as well, of course. But it's impossible to give any accurate dates. And Olivelle refers to the origin of ascetic tradition to the first millennium BCE, the middle of the first millennium BCE. So a brief historical overview, which you can find in Olivelle, really. He's excellent on the ascetic traditions in India. And there's a debate about the origins, whether the origins of asceticism lie in non-Aryan groups or in the Vedic Aryan tradition. Do you remember, some weeks ago, we talked about this distinction, that there is one argument that Hinduism is complex because of the different cultural variables that go into it, and so there were... This is the old story. The groups of Aryans came in from the north, and this is the 19th century version, and conquered the Indus Valley culture, and there was sort of cultural hegemony over the north of India, which soon spread to the south, and put the local tradition, made the local population subservient. That was the old model. There was, more recently, that's been completely questioned as a sort of colonial construction, as it were. And certain modern Indian historians argue that Aryan culture is actually, Vedic culture, is actually Indus Valley culture, that the Indus Valley was an Aryan culture. But that in turn has been refuted by people like Witzel, who argue on linguistic grounds mainly, and some archaeological grounds, that there were indeed Aryan migrations into the north of India, but not an invasion, but rather migrations, and that the local cultures became subservient, a bit like, I suppose, the English in Wales. I mean, where you've got bilingualism, but English predominated for many years, something like that. Now, the with regard to renunciation, one of the old arguments was that the Aryans were non-renouncers, no renunciation in Aryan Vedic religion. And that so renunciation in India must have come from the indigenous population that sort of filtered through into the Aryan Vedic culture. So that was the old sort of view. So that really, there are essentially two views there. The non-Aryan origins of asceticism, and that's because... Buddhism, asceticism seems to develop up in Kashmir and Nepal on the edges of Aryan influence. So that's one argument for the non-Aryan, non-Vedic origins of asceticism. Another idea is that the Tribhurga, do you remember the Tribhurga, the three purposes of life, dharma, social duty, artha, wealth, and karma, desire or pleasure. Those three goals of life are originally just three, and then later you get moksha added, the fourth goal of life, added onto those three. And moksha is the goal of renunciation. So again, perhaps indicating the non-Vedic origin of renunciation. And I suppose, thirdly, the Upanishads which discuss renunciation are quite late. So in the Rig Veda, you don't get much about renunciation, nor in the Brahmanas, but the Upanishads speak about renunciation and ideas associated with renunciation, such as karma and reincarnation, seem to come in the later texts. Now, the opposite view to that is that renunciation and asceticism are indeed Vedic traditions, particularly presented by Heisterman in his various publications, and that asceticism is a logical outcome of what's inherent in the Vedic tradition earlier on, and that renunciation is inherent within the early Vedic culture. Because you have ascetic ideals in the early tradition. So what we saw last week, when you perform the sacrifice, the yajamana, the the patron of the sacrifice, the person who's paying for the sacrifice, has to undergo purificatory rites, like sitting in a small hut, a sort of sweat lodge type thing, and certain food restrictions. So there is asceticism there to some extent. And also, the Brahmanical purity laws are quite ascetic, and so Heisterman argues that the Brahmin is close to the renouncer. The renouncer gives up food, particularly some kinds of food and sex, and restricts the body in various ways in order to achieve a higher goal. And the Brahmin approximates to that ideal of complete renunciation. That's Heisterman's argument. Olivel thinks that there's merit in both arguments and argues that it's actually impossible to sort out, to separate out Aryan from non-Aryan elements in early Vedic culture. It's almost it's a rather sterile debate because all cultures and all societies are multi-level but complex. And now it's almost impossible to separate out these different elements that went into the melting pot of early Vedic society. Having said that, Olivel does identify two early groups in the Vedic traditions, in the textual corpus, what he calls the anchorites and the renouncers. The anchorites are hermits who live on their own in the forest or in small groups, and they're completely isolated from society. But, not quite sure how they would have earned their living, presumably through small farming or something like that. And the renouncers are those who live in a sort of symbiotic relationship with the society and are sustained through begging. And they began to form small communities, but were essentially celibate and concerned with these other ideals, non-householder ideals of liberation and freedom from suffering. Now the anchorites died out, Olivel argues, but the renouncers remained. And you can see references to these anchorites in Kalidasa's Shakuntala and so on, his forest hermits. So Shakuntala was born in a hermitage in the forest. Now, with regard to the origins, the rise of renunciation, regardless of whether it's Aryan or non-Aryan, there are certain political and economic developments in the Ganges plain in the first millennium that must have allowed or facilitated some members of society sort of dropping out, as it were, and becoming world renouncers to seek a higher goal. And Richard Godbridge writes about this in his various publications, particularly in that Theravada Buddhism book. And that there's rapid urbanisation and there's trade, and so you have a surplus of wealth. So you have to have a surplus of wealth in a community to support renouncers and ascetics. So there could have been a surplus of wealth because of this rapid urbanisation and development of trade. Also, Richard Godbridge argues that because of urbanisation, it's possible that disease spread. There was sort of a rapid rise of virulent, rather nasty diseases, avian flu or something, and that spread throughout the communities. And gave an emphasis on suffering. In the Buddhism, the first noble truth is suffering. So there was actually, he argues, that apart from the sort of general existential human condition, apart from that, there was actually a lot of suffering around the time due to disease. Godbridge's argument. And there could be a lot of truth in that. So anyway, whatever happened, you've got a political and economic development in the Ganges Plain, the beginning of the rise of kings who then patronised different ascetic groups, particularly in the medieval period. And these groups facilitated by this rapid urbanisation and surplus of wealth. But that doesn't explain that's not a causal explanation of the rise of asceticism or renunciation in India. Early ascetic communities were voluntary. You volunteered to become an ascetic, to go and seek liberation. And they probably, Yavli Bell argues, well, he observes rather, they're probably the first sort of voluntary institutions in the world, the ascetic communities. So they're voluntary. That's quite an important point that I'll return to later on. Now you do get early ascetic figures in the Yajamana, for example, who undergoes asceticism or tapas. Tapas means heat, but it's this inner heat that you create through various practices, bodily practices, techniques of the body. And also in the early tradition you get a group called the Vratyas, those who had undertaken a vow, who could have been on the edges of Vedic society, who seem to have the characteristics of ascetic groups. And there's an interesting hymn called the Keshin hymn, which you've got in front of you. And this is in the Rig Veda. So this is a translation by Wendy Donico. Have you got that sheet there? Yeah. Long hair. Keshin means the long-haired one, or one with hair. Hairy one. Long hair holds fire, holds the drug, visha, holds sky and earth. Long hair reveals everything so that everyone can see the sun. Long hair declares the light. Completely incomprehensible. These ascetics, swathed in the wind, put dirty red rags on. When the gods enter them, they ride with the rush of the wind. Pray, I don't have the Sanskrit here, but I think that the phrase is actually digambara, clothed with the sky or clothed with the wind. So it seems to be that this figure it's looking at represents some early kind of ascetic with long hair. Crazy with asceticism as tapas. We have mounted the wind, our bodies are all you mere mortals can see. He sails through the air, looking down on all shapes below. The ascetic is friend to this god and that god, devoted to what is well done. The stallion of the wind, friend of gales, lashed on by gods. The ascetic lives in the two seas, on the east and on the west. He moves with the motion of heavenly girls and youths, of wild beasts. Long hair, reading their minds, is their sweet, most exciting friend. The wind has churned it up. Kunam Nama prepared it for him. Longhair drinks from the cup, sharing the drug with Rudra. It was a very strange poem, this, a very strange hymn. It stands out in the Rig Veda. Well, you've certainly got elements of later ascetics. You've got the long-haired figure. You've got possible drug-taking by the ascetic. You've got the idea of heavenly flight, sails through the air. Acharya, move through the sky. Or it could be some inner sky, some inner experience. And he moves with the divine beings, the heavenly girls and youths. The Apsarasis and the Gandharvas. And interesting here, the last verse, you've got Kunam Nama, who is a goddess, and her name means something like the crooked one, and she only occurs here in the Rig Veda. But later tradition, by the 11th century, you've got various texts to a crooked goddess, the Kuchika Mata Tantra, for example, and Kundalini, as you've probably heard of, means the coiled one, or the crooked one. So it could be an early reference to a goddess who appears in later traditions. Who knows? And Rudra, of course, is an early name, or another name for Shiva. So it could be an early Shaiva ascetic here. but that's all highly speculative. And the visha could also be a reference to some mythology where Shiva drinks poison and absorbs the poison into himself. But who knows? But anyway, the point is that in this hymn seems to bear witness to an early kind of yogi or an early kind of ascetic way back in the Rig Veda. Okay, let's move on then to Brahmanical traditions of asceticism. You certainly had early renouncer of traditions with Buddhism and Jainism, which still exist today, and then you have other traditions which have died out, such as the Ajivikas, Syadvardins, various other groups. Now, what do they share in common? Often they're characterised as being anti-ritualistic, or anti-Brahmanical ritual anyway. I would question whether they're actually anti-ritualistic, because asceticism, it strikes me, must be seen in a ritual context. It's a highly ritualised, only differently ritualised idea, as we'll see. You get key ideas, okay, possible anti-ritualism or anti-Vedic ritual, or the internalization of the Vedic ritual, the internalization of the sacrifice that you get in the Brahmanical tradition, in the Upanishads. You get the idea of samsara developing, that the world is a place of suffering in which beings are constantly reborn. And the goal of life then becomes to escape from the cycle of rebirth, liberation in nirvana, in the Buddhist terminology, moksha. Although nirvana, the word nirvana, of course, is used in the Gita as well. So moksha, liberation from this cycle, to free the soul from its entrapment in the world, that becomes another key idea in the ascetic and renunciation traditions. And other ideas are yoga and meditation. You can attain this state through practices of yoga and interiority, or inward meditation, as we'll see in a moment. And another important idea is non-harm, ahimsa. So you, because harming beings creates bad karma, as it were, you refrain from harm in order to purify the self. And also out of compassion for other beings. So these are important ideas in the ascetic and renunciation traditions. Now these ideals of renunciation become integrated into the Brahmanical system and become institutionalized through the ashrama system, which I mentioned last time, but which Patrick Olivelle has written so lucidly about in his book, The Ashrama System. And this is arguably a resolution of conflicting values. So there's the student stage, the householder stage, and then the forest dweller stage, which is a kind of renunciation. And finally, complete renunciation, where you give up your social self and you burn your sacred thread in the fire and you perform your own funeral and wander off with your bowl and your staff and your ochre robe in order to seek liberation. Now, this could be a resolution of conflicting values in the community between world affirmation, if you like, or the values of dharma, pleasure and wealth, and the value of world transcendence through renunciation, or the reaching of this goal of moksha. Olivelle argues that the ashramas were originally lifestyle choices, and that the forest dwellers represent the anchorites, these groups who lived in the forest or lived in the wilderness, communities of people out who had dropped out of mainstream society, as it were. And that the renunciation stage represents the renouncers in this distinction between the mix between anchorites and renouncers. In the text in front of you, you've got orthodox Brahmanical renunciation described here. This is the Dharma Sutras, the Dharma texts record renunciation and what you should do. Each of the stages of life is recorded in these texts or described, and then you have renunciation. The Dharma Sutras really represent ideal models of what a good Brahmin should do, and their connection with actual social reality is impossible to glean at as well. But go to page 204 and you've got preliminary rites. This is what you do when you become a renouncer. You have your hair, if you're a male, you have your hair, a head, beard, body shaved and your nails clipped. And get these things ready. Staff, sling, water strainer, water pot and bowl. Taking these, you go to the outskirts of the village or to the village boundary, or to a fire stall. eats a triple mixture of ghee, milk and curds, or drinks the water and then fasts, and then recites the that mantra. And then he recites this first foot by foot, and then half verse by half verse, and finally the whole verse, and each section of the verse. And it goes on, and then verse 18, again, before sunset, he puts firewood into the householder's fire, brings the summer fire to that spot, draws the blazing offertorial fire out of the householder's fire, melts the ghee over the householder's fire, and strains that ghee, and he puts the firewood into the offertorial fire, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to go through it all, but what the point, I mean, what you see here, this is highly ritualized behavior. There's nothing non-ritual about this. It's completely ritualized. The act of renunciation, the rite of renunciation, is a ritual. And the renouncer thereafter lives a highly constrained and ritualized life. So although at one level it's the giving up of ritual or the internalization of ritual, at another it's a complete takeover by ritual. You give up your life to a life of ritualized behavior. Only a different kind of ritualized behavior. So at the next page, 206, you've got rules of conduct. Once you become a renouncer, you follow these rules of conduct. Verse 18, from now on you should not wear white clothes. Let him carry a single or triple staff. There's a big debate about that on accounts. And he has these vows: abstaining from injuring living beings, speaking the truth, not stealing, abstaining from sex, and renunciation. He also has five secondary vows: not giving way to anger, obedience to the teacher, not giving way to carelessness, purification, and purity with respect to food. And you have rules about food, about begging. And at verse 9, further down there, on page 207, he said, this is a man who offers sacrifices in his self. So the sacrifice is internalized within yourself. It is said, a man who is firmly rooted in the self, firmly established in the self, a man who guides his self to final bliss. So you've got that internalization of the sacrifice. And then you look into yourself, gazing beyond the darkness upon the highest light, which is actually within you. So on page 208, he then goes on to discuss special vows. And indeed, ascetics still do this today, male ascetics. Intent, verse 15, special vows, intent on standing during the day, keeping silence, sitting on the haunches during the night, bathing at dawn, noon and dusk, keeping the vow of eating at every fourth, sixth or eighth mealtime. So these are very sort of quite severe asceticisms in a way. Or taking a vow to hold your arm up in the air for 12 years, and then taking it down after 12 years. Which, has anyone seen that film, The Kumbhan Mela, where you get these kinds of arms? Or taking a vow not to lie down. So you rest on a hammock and never. Well, at least publicly, never lie down. And stand, yes, keeping silent, which is perhaps the most difficult of them. Okay, so you've got that highly sort of ritualized behavior, but as also, that's the exterior. Those ritualized behaviors are actually to facilitate a certain kind of inwardness or a certain kind of interiority that's cultivated by asceticism. Now that interiority is not individuality in the way that Dumont described it, but is nevertheless a subjectivity that's developed through adherence to those external rules. And there's also, within the ascetic traditions, you get these philosophical questions arising about the nature of the self. And most Indian philosophy, if you like, comes from the ascetic traditions, the speculations about the nature of the self. So you've got two discussions, if you like, which are particularly important in understanding the ascetic self, what you might call the ascetic self in the Brahmanical tradition. One is a primarily philosophical concern about the nature of the self and the nature of agency, particularly. And the other is a sociological concern about the relation of renunciation to the social order. Now, they're linked, those two issues, insofar as the true nature of the self and agency is thought to be the prerogative of the renouncer, who's formally stepped outside of normative social transactions. But there are also deep questions arise in the tradition about the values of the householder and the renouncer's lives in relation to each other, the purpose of human life within a wider cosmological framework. Why are we here? What's the meaning of life, and so on. And the issue is arguably distilled into the question that Arjuna puts to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita as to which is better, the performance of action or its renunciation. Which is better, the performance of action or the renunciation of action? And you could argue that much of the tradition is in response to that question. That question is at the heart of the text, and is indeed behind the opening problem of whether Arjuna should fight in the great battle. And the solution of the text is that the true renunciation is internal, is a detachment from the fruits of action rather than the non-performance of action. So the Gita is an attempt to reconcile these two positions of action in the world, which is enjoined in the Veda, injunction, particularly ritual action, and the renouncer ideal that you have to give up action, particularly ritual action, to achieve this goal of liberation. So the Gita is actually both are true, but it's an inner renunciation. So you act in the world, but you're detached from your actions and from the results of your actions. So it's a proper mental cultivating, the idea is to cultivate a certain mental attitude towards action. So the true renunciation is the abandonment of desire for the results of one's actions. That's the true renunciation. And that's an inner virtue rather than an external lifestyle in the Gita. And you could argue that this tension between the performance of action and its renunciation is at the heart not only of the Gita, but of the Mahabharata as well, the great epic within which the Gita is a section. And the decision of Yudhishthira to renounce at the end of the epic reflects Arjuna's initial decision not to fight in the war, although Arjuna does fight in the war in the end. And this is clearly an issue of asceticism, the expression of action for social good, or the restriction of action for a transcendent goal, which the Gita tries to resolve by arguing for their compatibility. So you've got acting in the world for social welfare, for social good, versus the renunciation of action for a transcendent goal, and the Gita says you can have both, you can both be reconciled with each other. You can act in the world, but become detached from the results of your action. Okay, with regard then to the philosophical concern that I mentioned about the nature of the self and the nature of agency, two ideas seem to arise in the text. First of all, the idea of self-knowledge and the idea of what that might be called interiority or inwardness. And these are the goals of ascetic practice. And the goal of practice is it becomes the realization that the will is illusory, or in some sense, the true nature of the self is actually without agency. So you've got the idea in the early ascetic traditions, the philosophical idea that the true self is beyond what you think of as your normal self. I want a cup of tea, I walk down the road, I act. Those are, according to the early ascetic traditions, well, even the later ascetic traditions, are not the true self. The true self is actually fundamentally a non-acting being, a non-acting agent, is a passive observer, a passive witness to the world, on the world. That's the true nature of the self. And the goal of renunciation asceticism is to realize the true nature of the self as essentially passive. So there's a paradox, I think, in the ascetic traditions, in that you assert, in order to realize or to establish the eradication of the will, you assert the will in acts of renunciation, in acts of asceticism. So I've called this the performance of the ambiguity of the self in the a book called The Aesthetic Self, the assertion of the will is in order to eradicate the will. So you assert the will in acts of fasting, for example, or holding your arm up in the air for 12 years in order to realise its eradication, or that you actually are not the actor, and that Krishna is the actor, or whatever the terminology of the tradition is that you're in. In the Gita, there's a quote here on page that I've given you. So there's a philosophical concern about the self, about agency, and how can and the paradox of acting in the world in forms of asceticism in order to eradicate the self or eradicate the will. And this idea is expressed in the Gita, for example, in this quote. You've got he who perceives non-action in action and action in non-action is wise among men. He performs all action in a controlled way. Now, this passage contains key ideas for the Indian views of the ascetic self. It's concerned with the cultivation of detachment and becoming yukta, becoming controlled or disciplined. And the term yukta, as you know, is a past passive participle from yuj, to yoke or control, as Eliade reminds us, from which the term yoga is derived. So the controlled or yoked self provides the model, the fundamental model for the ascetic self in India. And asceticism must be understood in the context of that idea of control. So the image of the yoke not only evokes the idea of control, but also ability, for a yoke is an enabling device that allows the pulling of a burden, it makes pulling of a burden easier. So it's not only a negative connotation of control, but enabling, it enables the self to be free of the constraints of samsara. Now, on this verse that you've got before you, there are different commentators have different ideas. So Shankara is a famous Indian philosopher who you've all probably heard of from the 8th century, who presents the following argument for the non-acting nature of the self. And he begins his commentary on that very passage by saying that the apparent contradiction that inaction can be seen in action and action in action is that action appears as inaction and inaction as appears as action. For the dull-witted, he says, for the dull-visioned, the ruda-drishta. And perhaps sensing that doesn't really tell us much, he then goes on to develop this idea of this contradiction in the text. He said the meaning of the passage is that action and inaction are confused by the ignorant. So we confuse action with inaction, he says. As, for example, when viewed from a moving ship, the trees on the shore appear to move, although they're motionless, or as the distant bodies appear to be still, although actually moving. And here he comes to the crux of his interpretation, that the metaphysical assumption that the self is without action, the true self is without action, but the ignorant confuse apparent action and inaction. As action pertains only to the body and the senses, it is really non-existent in the self. And he says this has been taught in the revelation, in primary and secondary revelation, Shruti, Smriti, and in logic, Nyaya. Action then is falsely attributed to the self, and should anyone think I am the agent, aham karta, or I act, aham karomi, he or she would be mistaken in attributing the qualities of the immutable self to that which does not belong to it, i.e. to the relative self, if you like, or the illusory self. And the person who understands that, the true nature of the self as agentless, is a controlled yogi, yukta yogi, and is wise and free, and his purpose is achieved. Now, for Shankara, the self-knowledge is the wisdom that the self is without agency, and that agency is illusory and is part of the realm of nature. So there's this distinction between Purusha and Prakriti that you may remember from the Samkhya tradition. Um, Purusha is the self and Prakriti is nature. So Shankara is saying anything I act, I do, I want a cup of tea, that's all within Prakriti and it's all illusion, all maya. But the Purusha is the true agent, which is passive, which is the witness, which is without agency. So the literal meaning of the verse 4.18, says Shankara, is that both activity and inactivity, pravritti and nirvritti, require an agent, but such an agent is illusory, and due to this illusion there is confusion between action and non-action. And liberating knowledge, the goal of asceticism, the goal of renunciation, means the realization that the self is passive. The true self of Shankara is the changeless passive witness, the Sakshin, who in reality is untouched by action and ignorance, and untouched by the coverings of the self, the apparent coverings over the self. Now, there are other interpretations of the passage. There's an interesting Shaiva Ramakanta, a student of Paladeva, writes an interesting interpretation. And then there's Ramanuja's interpretation. Ramanuja, also in the Advaita tradition, but not a non-dualist. Shankara was a qualified non-dualist. Vishishta writer, rather than a pure writer. And in his commentary on that verse, Ramanuja said that the term non-action actually refers to knowledge of the self. So, yeah, and at the very verse refers to someone worthy of liberation who can perceive action as a form of knowledge. So here Ramanuja is claiming that action is a kind of what it means by action here, non-action, sorry. What it means by non-action is knowledge of the self. Non-action is self-knowledge. And he goes on to, what is this self-knowledge? It's blissful experience of beholding the self. And the renouncer should give up experience of external objects, that's what the verse means, and find contentment within. He then quotes another verse from the Gita, which 5.24, which talks about happiness within, pleasure within, the inner radiance. And that's the yogin attains this through extinction in the absolute, or absorption in the absolute, that's what the verse says. And Ramanuja then fleshes this out to say that inner happiness and inner light is the consequence of liberation. So in the long view then, the Advaita tradition, to cut a long story short, is that the self is devoid of agency, the self is without agency, or is emptied of will, which is constituted of self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is the realization that the self is without will or without agency, and that's the goal of asceticism and renunciation. And this wisdom occurs within the self's interiority, within the self's inwardness. For one who is liberated appears to be like other people and performs ordinary actions in the world, but only in inner awareness perceives the self to be without action. So this metaphor of inwardness or interiority is central in these ascetic traditions. So, to sum up this so far, renunciation. Okay, you've got renunciation and asceticism in India, which develops from an early period. What's common to all these ascetic traditions is that they're highly ritualized. You give up the householder's life, but you perform an alternative set of rituals, and you join a different group. Dumont says you become the most individual of individuals, but. In a sense, that's not true, because you eradicate your individuality through giving up your name, your previous name, giving up your social position, performing your funeral so your widow can remarry, and dressing like everybody else. You know, you take on a different name and you wear an orange robe like everybody else in the community, or you go naked for the Naga ascetics. But although you give up individuality in that socially defined sense, you nevertheless develop a kind of inwardness and subjectivity which is key in these traditions, and they emphasize the development of this interiority. and that is in order to realize the non-agency of the self in the Brahmanical traditions. So you perform acts of will. Asceticism is an act of will. It takes an awful lot of will to hold your arm up in the air for 12 years or only once a week or something. And in order to give up, to eradicate the will, to eradicate the self, to realize it's the non-agents, you're ultimately, that you're ultimately not an agent. And this isn't within the text, but developing this idea, you might say that this is the ascetic self recapitulates the memory of tradition. So the ascetic self is within a tradition of asceticism. All these are specific traditions, and you become a renouncer in order to form yourself in the shape that the tradition dictates, into the shape that the text dictates. And those texts claim that there's a goal, a higher goal than the goals of dharma, artha, and karma, pleasure, wealth, and social responsibility, which is transcendence of the world, which is the realization of the true nature of the self. And that goal, if you like, is a future goal, but it's also the origin of the tradition in some sense, which for Ramanuja is the Lord, and which for Shankara is Brahma, the truth. So the ascetic, you might say, recapitulates the memory of tradition, and secondly, the ascetic performs the ambiguity of the self, which I've described. And this ambiguity of the self is the eradication of will through the act of will, through its assertion. So how do you do this? You do this through effort, mostly, although there is the idea of grace in the theistic traditions, but mostly through effort, and particularly through yoga. Yoga and renunciation. Now, yoga is... Yoga is one of the six classical systems of philosophy, which I don't want to go into, but in about... between 200 BC and 200 AD, a figure called Patanjali wrote the Yoga Sutras, composed the Yoga Sutras. Which describe the method whereby for his system, the realization of liberation can be achieved. Now, what that means for yoga, for Patanjali, is different from what it means for Shankara and Ramanuja. But the method seems to be constant. And it is, the basic ideas of yoga, that consciousness can be transformed through focusing attention on a single point. You can transform the mind through focusing attention on a single point, concentration. And that this transformation of consciousness eradicates limiting mental constraints such as greed and hate. So usually the mind is thrown around by different desires, I want a cup of tea, what's for dinner, don't like him, whatever. And then the idea is that to control that process through concentrating on a single point, stop that fluctuating mind. And yoga is a discipline, or range of disciplines, constructed to facilitate the transformation of the mind. Another assumption on this that I got on this list in front of you is that consciousness, or citta, which is the process of being aware, determines the reality or the world of beings' experience. That's a fundamental principle in these systems, as indeed in Buddhism and Jain traditions as well. So you change your consciousness, you change your citta, and then you change your loka, you change your world of experience. So there's a relationship between citta and loka. So if you've got a cold, you're miserable, that's the world seems a miserable place or something, But it means more than that. It means actually, if you go into some yogic absorption called samadhi, the physical world of the senses disappears, and you experience other worlds in other realms, and mental or not interior worlds. So When you're in a dream, your consciousness, your chitta, determines the world that you experience. So that's a fundamental principle. Another idea is that consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects. I mean, that's a Greek idea as well, that the mind takes on the form of its objects. So if you focus on pure forms, your consciousness is transformed to the level of those forms. Whereas if your consciousness is attached and attracted by lower forms all the time, then it goes to those lower forms. And the aim of yoga is liberation, but for Patanjali that meant isolation. That meant that the soul becomes isolated on its own, separated from Prakriti. That's another core setting called the different ideas of liberation. So we won't really go into that. But the point is, I want to emphasize is that these processes are shared across the different ascetic traditions. And Shankara wrote a commentary on the Yoga Sutras as well. So the first four Yoga Sutras, Atta Yoga Anushasanam, now the teaching about yoga. And what is yoga? Yoga chitta vritti nirodhaha. Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. That's the heart of the great definition of yoga. What is yoga? Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations, the chitta vrittis, the wandering, turning of the mind. And if that doesn't happen, there's conformity to the fluctuations. If there's no control over the mind, then the mind conforms, takes the shape of the fluctuations of the mind, i.e. its objects, its fluctuating objects. And Patanjali said there are five kinds of fluctuations, tending towards harm or non-harm, and then he gives a list of them. Valid condition, misconception, conceptualization, sleep and memory, and then he goes on. But the essence of yoga is in those first four verses. Well, we've covered a lot of material this morning. By way of summarizing then, you've got asceticism. Ascetic tradition is extremely important in India. Dumont says that all the creativity comes after the ascetic traditions, and I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's a dispute over the origins of asceticism. We've looked at that, whether it's Aryan or non-Aryan. We looked at the Brahmanical tradition of asceticism and some of the key ideas, which are the internalization of the sacrifice, samsara, liberation, yoga, and non-harm. And we looked at the ashrama system, the idea that there's a tension between the householder values and the values of asceticism and renunciation. And there are attempts to reconcile these, the ashrama system being one attempt, and the Bhagavad Gita being another attempt to reconcile these conflicting values. And then we then went on to look at the notion of action and non-action, particularly with reference to that verse from the Gita. And we then looked at Shankara and Ramanuja, and the idea seems to be developing that renunciation is about realizing that the self does not act, and that asceticism is a technique or method to realize the non-acting nature of the self through an act of will is a paradox. And that the Gita has a solution, that actually the performance is not that you shouldn't stop acting, it's that you renounce the fruits of your actions. So you can still act in the world, fulfill your householder responsibilities, but become detached from the fruits of your action, which is the goal of renunciation. And finally, then, there's a method, the methods, that's fifthly, I think, fifthly, the methods to achieve renunciation, to achieve the goal of renunciation are yoga, giving up the world. And yoga is particularly important in achieving that goal. I'll stop talking. Questions and comments?
What would the ascetics, what would they have thought about the kind of Upanishadic equation of Atman and Brahman?
The Upanishadic ascetics, that's what the goal they will be seeking.
Okay.
They'd agree with that. Other kinds of ascetics, like the Buddhists, would reject that. Mm. In fact, the Buddha went into the notion of no self and so on, to reject the Upanishad view. But nevertheless, they share certain features in common, like giving up the world, celibacy, restriction of food, and those kinds of. So the method, if you like, is shared, but the goal is different according to different traditions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just ask if Oliver looked into any sort of anthropological approaches to asceticism? Because the lady called Jeanne Openshaw looked into the bowels.
Yeah.
And she sort of had the conclusion that those sort of ascetics tended to renounce purely because they were quite poor.
Yes.
And all that sort of, as opposed to being an actual lifestyle choice, they
yes.
didn't really have much of a choice. They chose
yes.
they had to do it. So.
I think that's an excellent point, yeah. No, Oliver doesn't look at contemporary anthropology. He looks at textual history, but that's a really good point. Many of these ascetics, it's probably not a lifestyle choice, but perhaps they were forced into it through poverty, as Jen shows with the bowels. Yeah, that's a good thing. The bowels are actually interesting because I think you can be a married bowel.
Yeah,
sure.
They're sort of partnered.
Yeah.
So the male and female sort of together.
Yeah.
And both are important. You have to have your wife with you. So.
Right. Yeah. So it's more complex there. But it's a good point. These traditions carry on right to the present day. All right, free fall. Anyone can only say anything.
You mentioned today and also last lecture about the purusharthas, that moksha was added afterwards, and I just wonder what's the evidence for that. Isn't it possible that both tradition could be there, I mean both ways could be there simultaneously, because I mean you have a karmakanda tradition simultaneously as you have a more yogic or ascetic tradition.
I think the ascetic renouncer traditions are old and they go back a long way, but there were the Tribhanga was there were the moksha was added, I mean just textual historically it was added later to the four goals, but it was certainly a goal before then. I wouldn't like to say that. I mean it's I don't know when the first occurrence of the word is. It must be in the Upanishad somewhere. There's a job for someone to look up to the earliest occurrence of moksha, but certainly yeah, you've got the renouncer tradition, which develops. He still argues it comes out of the Vedic Brahmanical tradition, but you also have a household tradition developing. The Mimamsakas emphasize ritual action and a kanda karma section, the karma sections of the text. Sorry, did I address what your question? Probably doesn't.
Yeah, I think so. I think the dates there are linked into the overall concept of reincarnation as well, which is I think moksha was understood was around about 8th, 7th century in BC.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to look at the concept of reincarnation. Would you agree with that in order to answer that question and where that all fits in?
Yeah, I agree. Yes, that's right. And that seems to come in fairly late, I think. Although there was a book by Herman on the reincarnation in the Rig Veda, but it doesn't seem to be there. It seems like you've got two models.
Yeah.
One is one is a model of the ancestors, and when you die you go to the model of the ancestors. The other is reincarnation, and that seems to come in with the Upanishads, as you say, about 800 BC or something like that. And the two models, there's an attempt to reconcile the two. We could pick up that next week, actually. We'll start with that next week.
This hymn, the translation there, actually fascinates me because as I read it, the picture that I get in my mind is the celestial dance of Shiva.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes.
It is the celestial, because the long head holds fires, holds the drop, holds the sky, earth, long hair reveals everything.
Oh, yes.
So that everyone can see the sun, the long hair declares the light.
Yes.
That is the celestial dance of Shiva.
Indeed.
And Rudra, even though was regarded in the early Vedas to be the howling not a god, the howling monster,
yeah,
who was feared and prayed to say, don't upset me. But later on, Rudra becomes Shiva.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, he moves the motion of the heavenly girl. That's why he's called Natyaraja, Nataraja.
Yes.
So his movements are, he's the lord of the dance. The youths, the wild beasts, the long hair, reading their mind is the sweet and most exciting friend.
Yes, could be and Shiva, couldn't it?
It is a description of the celestial dance because the wind has churned it up. Kunamanna prepared it for him. Long hair drinks from the cup. This is when they churn the ocean to get the nectar.
Mm-hmm.
The first that comes out is, one of them is the poison.
Mm-hmm.
The only person who can drink it is Shiva.
Yeah.
So this whole thing, basically, is if you...
Proto-Shiva hymn, isn't it?
It is the proto-Shiva hymn. It's the way the Shiva doing the celestial dance.
Yeah.
But he also takes an ascetic form as well, doesn't he?
He does, but in the
Which
celestial form, he is an ascetic who is dancing the celestial dance. And that is given with the creation of the world, the creation of grammar, creation of everything.
Yeah, that's right. Well observed.
This comes up very clearly there. Maybe